Did you know that Logia, a journal of Lutheran theology, sells CDs and audio downloads of teachings by some of the top Lutheran theologians in the country? Check out Logia's 99-cent download of the month at shoplogia.org. Shop L-O-G-I-A.org. You'll also find books published by Luther Academy and, of course, the quarterly Logia Journal at shoplogia.org. Continuing education for the confessional Lutheran, shoplogia.org. I remember sitting in high school, and now I date myself, sitting in high school so many years ago, decades ago, and taking biology, and I was fascinated by it, but I very quickly understood that the subject was too big for my feeble mind. There are things that I understand, and then there are things in this world that I don't understand. I don't know if I ever could, but especially in high school, my mind was addled by many things, and biology was too big for me. I was interested in it, but it was too big for me, and I've thought often, it was such a childhood love. Maybe I'd like to go back to it sometime and study it, but you know what's happened? The body of knowledge that is human biology, not to mention biology in general, has grown exponentially since I graduated from high school. What we thought we knew then, much of it we know better now. And the things we only knew vaguely then, now we understand so much better. And I'm speaking as someone outside the discipline. That's why it's always good to have someone from inside the discipline join us as a guest on the program to talk about the complexity of life, the vast sum of knowledge that is still unfolding before us as science looks at the human biology, and its best explanation. Dr. Kevin Voss is an assistant professor of philosophy and director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute at Concordia University, Wisconsin, and he's author of an article in the latest Lutheran Witness magazine titled Wonder and Elegance. Kevin, welcome back.
Pleasure to be here with you.
And there's no doubt about it, in the last 100 to 150 years, the knowledge of human biology has exploded. Far beyond probably any other branch of science. Has the new knowledge, has it tended to favor evolution as an explanation or something else?
I think that depends on your point of view, actually. I think it's more of a faith presupposition, which what you believe. For example, evolutionists start with a basic premise that of what we'd call methodological materialism, where they believe that everything that we see is all that there is, that there's really no purpose to the universe, that it can sort of exist on its own and through various methods put forth the life that we have today, but there really is no purpose or reason why things are here. Things just sort of happen. And it's interesting, I actually received an email about my article from someone who disagrees with my point of view and pointing out how I could, and asking how I could believe yet in the idea of creation versus evolution, how I as a scholar could actually believe that. And I think there's more evidence that shows that that creation is certainly a rational approach to the way things are. In fact, as I pointed out in my article, the passage which says that Romans 1:20 reads, "For God's invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." So really, if someone takes an unbiased look at how things are, I believe that the evidence that has been developed over the last 100 or 200 years actually would clearly point to a designer in creation. But unfortunately, people today are, in academia especially, are biased against that point of view and have a presupposition that excludes God. And evolution is a way of them excluding God from the whole system of their beliefs. And so they grab onto that and hold on to that idea.
A major feature, as you write in your article, of kind of an apologetic for design is complexity. And most of us just come at this with a complete layperson's understanding of things. How complex are we talking?
Very complex. In fact, I remember being in veterinary school and studying the structures. This was quite a while ago now. This is in the 70s, an eon ago, according to my students. But looking at the structures, especially one of the first classes we took was called histology. Histology is the study of microscopic structures of cells and being able to identify the structures of one cell versus another and actually telling what part of the body it comes from. And I just couldn't fathom all of the intricacy in those cells and couldn't understand, actually, how that could have come about from evolution. Although, really, probably at that point in my life, when I was a student at the University of Minnesota, I probably accepted evolution to some degree because it had been drummed into me for 3 years of pre-veterinary medicine courses like zoology and biology, and it was really the presupposition of everything. Even though they call it a theory of evolution, it really isn't taught as a theory. It's kind of a given and the basis for biology and zoology textbooks today in universities. And I remember questioning that at the time, and that I thought of that as I wrote the article. And when I was actually tasked with the I was given the task of writing an article that demonstrates the complexity, wonder and complexity of creation. And I actually, it's interesting you mentioned apologetics, because I actually thought right away, well, I've got some apologetics resources that would come in handy. And I was able to attend the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights a few years ago, and I intend to go again this summer. In fact, I've signed up for it, and I remember those resources, and so that's those sources are what I used to write the article.
One of the things you mentioned, and you cite the great work and insight of Dr. David Benton, who's a regular guest on the program, and he has a rather now famous presentation that he gives on the eye, I think in particular the human eye, since he's a former and a professor emeritus of anatomy at Washington University Medical School. Take us through his observations there.
His basic idea, as I gather it, is and how I understand it, is the eye is a wonder of God's creation in its complexity. When you think about it, God has given us a camera for eyes, and not only one, but two of them, so that we have stereoscopic vision. We have built-in 3D vision. We have essentially, it's like a video, a digital video camera. It's running all the time, recording, and it's in high definition, which was really just not invented till a few years ago, and it's amazing how high definition has really cleared up TV. It's just amazing to me, especially because my eyesight is rather obscured because I have astigmatism. But the outer surface of the eye is remarkable because it has a built-in wiper system with a washer built-in. We call them tears. And another amazing feature of the eye is that it instantly repairs itself if there's a minor defect, if it's serious, and sometimes it can't, but probably because of I can't help but wonder what would happen in a sinless world, how much our eye could repair itself. But if there's something that's significant but not that doesn't violate the structure of the eye, it instantly repairs itself, unlike our digital cameras. And I don't know how many digital cameras I've thrown away because they stop working. And then the outer surface of the eye where the light enters the eye is called the cornea. That's a clear part of your eye. And that actually is responsible for focusing the majority of light that comes into your eye, and that's the part that actually is modified during LASIK surgery, where they actually help it to refocus. And that's the clear part of your eye, sort of the outer glass covering of the lens, so to speak, or the outer, so it's actually a lens and it's an outer covering of your of the eye. And then when the light enters the eye, it passes the iris. The iris is an automatic, we call it an iris and a camera, too. It focuses how much light enters the eye, and it automatically expands and contracts according to how much light is in the environment. And not only that, God has given the iris color It's able to function also as a distinguishing characteristic of our bodies, looking at someone's eyes. They always say that the eyes are the windows to the soul. And that is so true, because not only is the eye a light-gathering device and a processing device, but it seems to be more than that. It's almost an expression of our inmost being is kind of expressed through our eyes. So that's another whole function of the eye I didn't even talk about. And then when the light goes further in the eye, you encounter the lens that changes automatically in shape according to whether you want to focus close by or if you want to focus on near objects. So that's also, you have an autofocus mechanism built into your eye. The inside of the eye is coated dark so that light doesn't bounce around in there and obscure things and make things blurry. And then the back of your eye, the retina, is like really, we used to call it, used to compare it to film in a camera. Now it's probably more accurate to compare it to a CCD chip in a digital camera that automatically records all the light that's coming in there. And there are a lot more functions in that. It automatically adapts to low light conditions, to bright conditions, where you can see color more clearly. And then it's able to translate all that into nerve impulses that go to your brain, where your brain can process it. And then there's a whole other story of how your brain processes these images.
Now, with all that said, I mean, it sounds like the basic argument, and we'll get to this on the other side of the break, is, and if any part breaks down, the thing doesn't work at all. We're talking about what they would deem an intelligent design argument, irreducible complexity. You take just the eye and you say to yourself, all right, what if it doesn't have that outer covering? Well, it will never focus properly, and it won't be protected. What if it doesn't have that aperture that allows more or less light in, depending on the light? What if it doesn't have that lens, or it's not working properly? Well, I know what that's like. I wear bifocals. They are corrective lenses. What are they trying to correct? Correct an eye, or in my case, a pair of eyes that just doesn't work the way it used to. Well, that all brings us to the argument of irreducible complexity. And we'll find out how it works in favor of a creator after this. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. The Lutheran Church of the Good Shepherd in Greenville, South Carolina, St. Paul Lutheran, Chatfield, Minnesota, St. John Lutheran, Napoleon, Ohio, First Lutheran, Lufkin, Texas, Concordia Lutheran, Sykeston, Missouri, Hope Lutheran, Granite City, Illinois, Trinity Lutheran, Gladson, Alabama, and Lord of Life Lutheran, Chesterfield, Missouri. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll advertise your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Holy Cross Evangelical Lutheran Church, Albany, Oregon, is a Mid-Willamette Valley LCMS congregation where the liturgy lives and God's people worship as one, with sound biblical doctrine, weekly communion, and a clear confession of Christ crucified for the sin of the world. Please join us at 2515 Queen Avenue Southeast, or visit our website at www.holycrosslutheranalbany.org.
For 20 years, we've lifted our voices and instruments to the hymns of Stephen Starkey. Now, CPH has the first ever CD collection of Pastor Starkey's works titled, We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God. This 12-track CD includes nearly an hour of music from the most beloved Lutheran hymn writer of our time. Order now. Use promotion code URA. We Praise You and Acknowledge You, O God, is only $15.99. CPH.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. We're talking about creation and the complexity of life on this Thursday afternoon, January the 17th. Dr. Kevin Voss of Concordia University, Wisconsin, is our guest. Kevin, you were talking earlier about the eye and all of its parts and how they all work necessarily together. I mean, without any of those parts, any single one of those parts, you don't have a functioning eye. Why is this a powerful argument in favor of design?
I think it's one of the more fascinating arguments for creation by design, and I was really intrigued by it when I first encountered it, and Michael Behe was one of the first authors to really talk about that, along with others, too. Irreducible complexity is the idea that certain structures could not have developed with time, which is the theory of evolution, that certain features of, let's say, an animal might have given it an advantage over other members of that species, and therefore that animal survived and the other ones didn't. And then gradually, with time, with more mutations and with certain advantages, animals having those qualifications or characteristics that favor them over other animals, eventually you will have an intact eye or an intact cilia, as I mentioned in my article, or the blood clotting system. But that the structures are so complex and so intricately designed that you need the whole thing working together at the end for it to function. And if you take out one of the components or multiple of the components, it just ceases to function. And it would actually be probably detrimental for the organism to have a semi-completed eye or a semi-completed cilia, because it would be just sort of an unnecessary appendage. So that's the idea of irreducible complexity, that you can't make things, certain structures, less complex, because if you do, they really can't function and they really don't give certain individuals an advantage over others.
So you mentioned a couple there. Cellular cilia, what are they and how do they demonstrate this complexity?
Cilia are sort of like little microscopic whiskers that stick out of certain cells or protrude from cells. We have them in our intestinal tracts. We have them in the fallopian tubes, the duct that goes from the ovary to the uterus, and it helps move the egg down from the ovary to the uterus. And you need these cells. We have them in our tracheas. And I could appreciate that. In the last few weeks, I caught the flu that's been going around, and it wasn't a pleasant experience. And I'm happy I'm mostly over it. But the cilia in your trachea help move up dead cells and bacteria to the point where you can cough it out and get rid of it from your body. And those cilia all work in coordination in order to move things along, almost like a conveyor belt in a factory. And if you look at the microscopic structure of those cilia, and Behe goes into this in some detail because that's his specialty. He also looks at flagellum, which are kind of whip-like appendages from bacteria that move them through fluids. All of them are really designed with their complex motors. And if you look at an electric motor, if you take out one component of a motor, it really ceases to function. You have to have the whole motor there for it to function. And it's very difficult to explain how little pieces of this motor could have developed over time to enable to make the cilia function or the flagellum on a bacteria. So that's what he's stressing.
So again, the idea there is if you take that back one stage in the alleged evolution of the feature, the cilia or the flagellum, you don't have a functioning cilia or flagellum. You have something that's kind of waiting to evolve, which is not the way that the evolutionists tell us these structures are. They don't kind of like wait to be later assembly required.
Mm-hmm.
They have to have a function at every stage of evolution.
Yeah, and actually that's speaks to the title of Behe's book, Darwin's Black Box. So if any of you haven't read it, I recommend that you read it, and he's got other books as well. But the black box is sort of a thing that we don't really know how it works, but it sort of works. And that was sort of the idea that Darwin had about a lot of things. He didn't really know how things work at the cellular level, but he just figured that they would just operate a certain way. And now that we've got the science to actually look at how incredibly complex these structures are, that you could easily use this science to say, I don't know how this could have happened by chance, that A, there was a purpose for it, and B, it's so complex that you need all the components there at one time for them to work properly.
There's a great example of that. One more example I'd like you to share with us again from Behe, and that is the clotting of blood.
Blood clotting, when you're a veterinary student or medical student or nursing student, it has to be one of the most frustrating things to try to learn. Because if you ever look at a blood clotting pathway, and if any of you are near your computers and want to do a Google search on blood clotting pathway, you'll see how complex they are. There are just so many factors involved. And it doesn't take much for it to malfunction. And most everything is there for a reason. Your blood is actually very complex. And if you think about it, it's amazing. Because if your blood clots too quickly or it clots inside your body, you'll have a stroke. But if your blood doesn't clot quickly enough, if you have a small cut in your finger, as people with hemophilia know, you can actually die from a small clot in your finger. So it's very complex. There are many components, and I can't off the top of my head recall how many, but probably at least 20 elements in the blood clotting tree that we have in our bodies, the whole system. And if any one of those malfunction, then your blood won't clot properly. And unfortunately, many people have inherited genetic factors that deprives them of certain parts of the blood clotting mechanism so that their blood does not clot properly. And it's really a hard life for them. I really feel sorry for anyone with a hemophilia disorder, because it's very difficult to live with that.
So what do the evolutionists, what explanation do they offer in that case or in the other cases where they say, and they have to recognize this is just kind of basic reason, that if you took one of those elements out of the complex clotting tree, you're going to get a dead individual. You're not going to get an individual just a little weaker than his more fit neighbor. You're going to have a non-functioning body. Do they have stories to explain it? Do they have explanations?
Well, they have some presuppositions that have kind of been ingrained into that perspective that sort of guides their point of view. I think and a lot of them don't recognize, unfortunately, that they have a bias as much as we would have a bias. I obviously would have a bias for the holy, inerrant, inspired Word of God, and I believe that we're created as the Bible says. And they have a bias for a system that doesn't necessarily, that includes evolution, whether they believe, of course, some Christians believe in evolution as well. They believe that God uses evolution or used evolution to create our wonderful world, and others use it to explain a mechanism without it. But actually, I have a letter here I can even read to you. I won't reveal the person's name, but this person wrote to me and gave his point of view from an evolutionistic perspective. He said, "You must know that the eye, cilia, clotting issues you described have been adequately explained from an evolutionary perspective. Many reasonably educated LCMS members would thus check out your comments on Google, as I also did. Here, for example, is," and he gives me a link, "the first of a dozen of initial responses I got from typing in biological evolution of the eye. Irreducible? Hardly. Mid-19th century Lutherans made an unfortunate error when they rejected Charles Darwin's theories of organic evolution. They should have quietly waited to see where it might go. If they had, the LCMS could have gradually and honestly incorporated the theory into its theology as the Catholics did. 100 years later, the discovery of DNA, RNA, which you inexplicably seem to celebrate, pretty much validated Darwin's theory." So there you have it. You have they do have theories, and many of their scientists have thought out an approach to circumvent the idea of irreducible complexity and disregard it. And then they also have a definite presupposition when he mentions DNA and RNA as proving the theory of evolution. I think the existence of DNA hardly disproves creationism, because if you have a single creator, Of course, he's going to use a similar system for designing all of his creatures. It just makes sense. Plus, all of the creatures have to live in the same world, so they have to have a similar biology. So it really is a bias, I think, in their from their perspective.
Dr. Kevin Voss is assistant professor of philosophy and director of the Concordia Bioethics Institute at Concordia University, Wisconsin. He's author of an article in the latest Lutheran Witness magazine titled Wonder and Elegance. We will post a link to the Concordia Bioethics Institute under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. Kevin, thank you for your time.
Oh, you're welcome.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to talk with Dr. Jeff Gibbs of Concordia Seminary in St. Louis about the Confession of St. Peter. Also tomorrow, we'll play Issues Etc., Soundbite of the Week. Well, a lot of it does come with your presuppositions, doesn't it? But you should know this, and I know that we have many listeners who favor a evolutionary or kind of semi-evolutionary explanation for all of this. You should be aware of where your thinking will lead. God doesn't fit into that theory. Whether you ask the ardent evolutionist, might you consider yourself a soft evolutionist or a theistic evolutionist? Ask the people who take it really seriously, who study the subject, and they'll tell you, what do you need God for? Evolution answers all the questions. And you might say, well, I guess I need God because I still want to believe in God. Well, that's not a reason. That may be your own personal reason, but that's not a reason based upon anything evolution teaches. Evolution doesn't need God. So get off the fence. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me. Amen." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths in the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly or annual contributor to Issues Etc. To find out how you can become an Issues Etc. confessor, apologist, reformer, or patron, check out the donate page of our website, issuesetc.org. Just look for the picture of Martin Luther posting the 95 Theses. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, Scripture, faith, grace, and Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc., and you.